Your Honor, ladies and gentlemen of the jury.
What you call a big shot attorney.
Now, it is incumbent upon us lawyers not to just talk about the truth, but to actually seek it, to find it, live it.
That is the most intelligent thing you've said today.
This is Attorney-Client Privilege with Jenna Ellis, where you get top trending headlines from the perspective of one of today's top constitutional lawyers. Now, here is your host of Attorney-Client Privilege, Jenna Ellis.
Welcome to Attorney-Client Privilege. I'm Jenna Ellis, and today we are going to be talking about worldviews in the first two segments of the program, and I'm really excited about that because as much as we are talking about the law on this program, all of the things that relate to the Christian worldview perspective of law, the Christian worldview, as we've talked about, is the underpinning ideology and the underpinning understanding of how we should think about every subject matter, and I happen to focus primarily in law, and as you know, the origin of law and where we understand law comes from and how we can look at what our government is supposed to do, what it's not supposed to do, where our rights come from, all of those things about who we are as human beings made in the image of God all go back to how we understand what is truth and what is non-truth. And so that has to also be even more broad than just the law. And so when we're looking at current events and we're looking at what's going on in our culture, we have to go back to what does truth say? What does our reality say? And most importantly, what does God have to say about this reality to which we're presented? And so I'm very excited to bring back on the program John Loeffler, who is a just radio veteran of many years and who is the host of Steel on Steel. You can find that at steelonsteel.com. Great friend of mine. And we got such a great overwhelming response to his last appearance on the program and when we were discussing some of these worldview things that John has agreed to have a weekly or monthly rather discussion with me about worldviews. And so we're going to have a monthly segment with John. So John, welcome back to Attorney-Client Privilege.
Yeah, and she wouldn't stop calling me day and night unless I did it. So, you know.
Yes. I begged. I was like, John, please. And that's why I said weekly and then had to correct myself of monthly because I'd prefer it to be weekly, frankly. So, yeah. So, John, welcome. And, you know, and the issue that's going on, of course, for the last couple of weeks has been Charlottesville. And now, you know, whether or not we should be removing these statues. And then the most ridiculous thing that has come up has been ESPN actually taking off the air and an Asian announcer whose last name was Lee, first named Robert, and that somehow this would trigger liberals to have some need for a safe space because, oh my gosh, his name is Robert Lee. What's your reaction to this, John?
Isn't the implication to that when they do that, they're saying to liberals that liberals are too stupid to figure out what's going on? Isn't that the implication? You have to think about these comments when people do. You know, when they say the Hispanic vote should vote this way or the black vote should vote that way or women should vote this way, what they're really saying to people is, you know, as a black man and Hispanic woman, you're too stupid to know what to vote for. We have to tell you.
Yeah, and that's a great point. And you know, I've been recently over the summer rewatching The West Wing, which is really a fascinating show to watch in 2017 because you know that was the late 90s, early 2000s, and to see what the Democratic perspective, the liberal perspective, was advancing, you know, 20 years ago, and seeing where those arguments got today. And John, one of the most fascinating insights is the former deputy chief of staff, that character. And he actually said, not, of course, not in front of the media, but behind closed doors, he said, you know, when the American public vote for Democrats, they want a mommy and they want someone to tell them what to do and to take care of them. When they want a dad and they want someone who is forceful, military, decisive action, they'll vote Republican. And I thought, you know, that is so true.
Yeah, it's interesting to watch how it goes. But if we want to focus on let's say what happened in Charlottesville, because the lessons out of this, it's what I did my editorial on this weekend. The lessons from Charlottesville are just terrific. I mean, remember, just right up until we started to have these protests and the conflicts, all we heard for 6 months was Russia, Russia, Trump, Putin, Russia, Russia, Trump, Putin, day and night. It was mostly speculation, not news, but it was 24/7. And all of a sudden, it's gone. And now we're all yelling about Confederate statues, which have been turning green for decades on end, and nobody seemed to mind them. And suddenly they're the epitome of evil. So what is this all about? And the one thing you have to remember whenever you're dealing with the real hardcore progressive elites, the issue is never the issue. The issue is always the outcome of the revolution, the long-term goal. And every issue is a stepping stone to get there. And so on one issue, they'll say one thing. On the next issue, they'll say something totally contradictory. And they don't care. The issue is simply to keep the friction going, as Saul Alinsky said, so that they can achieve social transformation. That's the goal. And so don't ever get sucked into these things. You know, there was a lot of debate as which side should we be on this? And I finally said, neither. You know, because it's a false dichotomy that's being set up here that, as you and I both know, if you know anything about the history of the country, is historically inaccurate.
Absolutely. And we're talking with John Loeffler, who is a veteran broadcast radio show host and the host of Steel on Steel. You can find that at steelonsteel.com. And so John, the reaction here, I mean, so what did you think to about President Trump's reaction to this? Because essentially condemning both sides, like you said, he didn't take a side. And I actually thought that it was a very good response, that it was very measured. He didn't just immediately run out there and start talking. He actually waited 48 hours. And then, of course, the left condemned him for that and said he should have been there sooner. Had he been there sooner, they would have condemned him for that. I mean, my response to that basically was, if he went out and said, I love puppies, the left would be, oh my gosh, Trump hates cats. I mean, he can't win. But what was your reaction to Trump's statements following this?
Well, it's interesting. If I can frame something and I'll answer that, let me give you a 20-second intro. We had here in North Idaho, where I live in Coeur d'Alene, you know, when I first moved here, we had the Aryan Nations headquartered here in Hayden Lake. I know that, as Jewish as I look, I had my trampoline slit by one of them. One of them was a potential landlord, and he wouldn't rent to me because of that, blah, blah, blah. Well, they're gone now. All right. They wanted to march down Sherman Avenue here in Coeur d'Alene. They got the permits, and then the same debate erupted. They marched. The locals all stayed away. And the problem we had was with the people coming in to do all of the protesting. All right. Do they have a right to march? Yes, they do. In this country, all speech is protected. It has to be, or we don't have freedom of speech. However, they were sort of showing up anticipating trouble. The people that came in to protest, they were looking for a fight. Okay, so both sides had hate. All you had to do was look at the videos, and you knew that both sides were haters. The problem we have today, Jenna, is the government and the politicians are very much there picking winners and choosers in the hate war. And my response is, hate is hate, and I don't care who's hating. There's not a stitch worth of difference between the Antifa people. They're just like the Nazi brown shirts, and they advocate totalitarian Marxist ideology versus the neo-Nazis and the KKK. There's not much difference. The difference, though, however, is the neo-Nazi groups are very small and very few people are following them. Large numbers of people following this totalitarian instinct of the Antifa, supposedly left, but they're not, because Marxism and fascism are both on the same side of the coin.
Right. And so what was your reaction then to President Trump, if I can follow up?
Well, I thought he was trying to wade into this thing. You know, when he said, well, there were honorable people on both sides, what he meant was there are honorable people on both sides as to what we should do with the statues or how we should treat the Confederacy. You know, when we go to Gettysburg, you have cemeteries there in which you have Confederate and Union troops buried. It's supposed to be a point of healing and say, we had honorable people on both sides of this conflict. If you go back and look in the history of how this conflict actually happened, remember, it was over the issue of secession, not over the issue of slavery. Slavery was the driving issue that precipitated it.
Exactly, which was really, you know, Robert E. Lee, as the Confederate general. I mean, he believed that Virginia as a sovereign state should have the ability to secede. And I respectfully disagree with him as a Federalist myself in terms of that the Constitution does not actually provide that legal mechanism. But if you look at who Robert E. Lee was, and understand his love and service to the people of Virginia, to his country. I think that it's perfectly not only acceptable, but actually very, very valuable to future generations to have statues of him, to recognize his contributions, to ask the questions, what did he think? What was he advancing? How can we consider those ideas and perspectives today? And so then for the left to, as you said, John, pick winners and losers, which they do in every category. I mean, that's what activism is. We see that in the Supreme Court. They pick winners and losers that will advance their agenda. And so when they are picking and framing the narrative like this, and so far to the extent that now anyone who's named Robert Lee somehow is, you know, is anti-American, to the extent that we have to remove him from the airwaves. I mean, this is just devolving into absurdity. And so how can we as conservative Christians best respond to this argument and actually think about this critically?
Which argument are you talking about now that you want to respond to?
Yeah. And so, I mean, I think, and that's a great clarification. I think overall, just the, how we're devolving into absurdity, and we're saying, rather than look at the history of what happened, we're now, choosing to take down statues, and then we're choosing to remove, people who have nothing to do with the Confederacy, and their name is just Robert Lee. I mean, I think that's been sort of a progressive devolution of the argument. And we're going to see that devolve even more. I mean, Greg Gutfeld last night on Fox News was saying, you know, are we going to ban the words monumental and statuesque now just because they have something to do with the argument? I mean, it was hilarious.
But the problem you're facing as I'm hearing it, Jenna, is you're accepting their framing of the debate. And that's the first step in rejecting this nonsense because, look, this whole issue about statues, the next time the issue du jour changes, it'll just go away. Right, we'll have all this howling and screaming. It will be swept under the board and we'll be on to the next issue du jour. What is the issue? Is to say that everybody on the right is some kind of a fascist, neo-Nazi, racist, which is absurd. If you look at the history of the Democratic Party, they're the last people to talk about that. In other words, if we say, here's the argument in Charlottesville. If it's tainted with slavery or segregation, it must be pulled down and abolished. Well, right at that point, you have to outlaw the Democratic Party. Because if you go back from 1840 to 1860, there were six Democratic Party platforms that supported slavery. Between 1868 and 1948, 20 Democratic platforms supported segregation. To be KKK and Democratic was virtually synonymous in the South. It was Roosevelt who put a KKK member, Alabama Senator Hugo Black, on the Supreme Court. I mean, you know, the Democrats oppose the ratification of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the Constitution. So if they're going to use that argument, fine, let's hold them to it. See, this is how absurd it is. But the first step is to tell the truth about history and about what this is all about. The second step is to not let them frame the debate, because their goal, I mean, the media in this country are now flaming the fans of hatred and racism higher and higher. And if we're not careful, something really bad's going to happen.
Yeah, and we're talking with John Loeffler, who is the host of Steel on Steel broadcast, and you can find that at steelonsteel.com, and a good friend of mine as well. And John, you know, when you talk about just speaking truth and actually not letting the left shape the narrative, it seems that the left, of course, is not seeking truth anymore. And regardless of how much we go back and we say, okay, wait a second, that's not true, let's look at the facts. Well, the left doesn't care about facts anymore. The left is going to build everyone up into a frenzy. And so they are already, you know, 27 steps down the road, and the media is hyped and talking about all of this. And nobody is taking that moment to pause and say, wait a second, what are we actually discussing? And so what I found frustrating, and I think what a lot of listeners find frustrating, is that no one in the left actually cares about truth. And so we are actually warring for the the better audience to actually not buy into the loudest speaker, but actually pause and reflect and be willing to gather those facts. So what would you suggest as a better way to say, to stop letting them shape the narrative? And yeah, we can speak truth, and I do every week on this program, you do, you know, every week on your program. And yet the left is still gaining traction, especially with younger people.
Now, let me tell you, okay, when you talk about the left, we're not talking about your average family member who's a liberal or a Democrat. And when I talk about progressives, I really mean the hardcore elite neo-Marxists. These are the ones that have shaped academia to where it is today, okay? As I said, you don't allow them to set the debate. And so, invariably, the right actually is winning the debates. What they're not winning is the strategic war in the media, although I think they are. I think there's enough pushback now that through alternative media. So that's why now they're trying to shut it down through what people can say on Facebook and Twitter and on YouTube. Okay, all in the guise of preventing hate speech. Hate speech is just another idea to try to shut down free speech. So that's where you need to fight it. But usually when somebody says, well, you know, you're a racist, your intelligent response to that should be, do you have anything important to contribute to this conversation? Okay, so what you've done is immediately, you know, just said, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. I'm not even going to address it with a reply, and I'm going to make you look a little foolish for even bringing it up.
Right, because if you respond to that and you actually give them and say, no, I'm not a racist and here's why, you've actually accepted that the premise of their question is legitimate enough that you need to actually provide evidence to the contrary. And that's not effective.
Yeah, and that's right. I mean, there's an African-American talk show host of mine, a friend of mine, who people would call up, and he had a California talk show, and they would say, well, you're an Uncle Tom. And he'd say, yes, I am. Now, do you have anything important to contribute, or you're just going to babble on? You know, Now, the second thing you can do is they try to stereotype you. Like, we just had some friends of ours just had their stepdaughter or stepsister come up, and she had all these stereotypes about what happens in Idaho. And she said, you're nothing like what they describe. And yeah, how about that? You know, about who will talk to you. But when somebody walks up and they say, well, you know, I'm in favor of saving the planet, and usually they expect people on the right to come against whatever the whole thing happens to be, and then you say, well, I am too, as a matter of fact. The problem is the way you're going about it will only make it worse.
Right. And John, and we're hitting the break, but we will be right back with John Loeffler, who is my special guest today, talking about Charlottesville, the reaction, and, of course, the cultural implications. Stay right with us. We'll be right back here on KLZ 560 with Attorney-Client Privilege. I'm your host, Jenna Ellis. Welcome back to Attorney-Client Privilege. I'm your host, Jenna Ellis, and I'm talking today with John Loeffler, who is a veteran of the broadcast radio industry, was actually here as a host at KLZ once upon a time before he is now in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and hosts Steel on Steel, which you can find on at steelonsteel.com. And welcome back, John.
Thanks. We're also, by the way, on all the major podcast sites. We have a weekly short show on that. And we always invite people to join our page, Praying for Persecuted Christians, on Facebook.
Yes, absolutely. So definitely check all of that out. And we are continuing the conversation about Charlottesville, the aftermath of that, and really not just limited to that issue, but how that narrative from the left and their agenda really ties in to how they're trying to change and shape the culture. And John, one of the biggest ways that they are attempting to do that is through academia. And we were starting to get into that before the break. And I read an article that actually one of my former students posted online with that reads the headline, How Evangelicals Support White Supremacy, Even Though They Reject Racism. It's from Salon.com. And it goes through the Southern Baptist Convention's response to white supremacy and racism. And they said, quote, all good stuff, but what comes next should raise eyebrows. quote, we hereby commit ourselves to eradicate racism in all its forms from Southern Baptist life and ministry, unquote. The article goes on to say, Southern Baptists don't express any genuine interest in eradicating racism from the world, just the denomination's own community. And so the article then pivots and basically says that just because these particular Southern Baptists are speaking on behalf of themselves, that somehow means that they don't actually care about whatever white supremacy means to them and racism, because they're only speaking for themselves and they didn't say, by the way, we're speaking on behalf of the world. Your response, John?
Well, first of all, what does white supremacy, supremacism mean? Okay. You need to understand academics. The radical left academics have had this loathing hatred for Western civilization, for the Constitution, for freedom, for well over 50 years. Woodrow Wilson, President Wilson, was one of the first who thought the U.S. Constitution had to go. You know, he the kissing cousins, secular humanists and the progressives, they didn't believe in that. They believed in a top-down, cradle-to-grave, we're going to take care of you, we're going to tell you what to think, the whole thing. And so this is all part of the attack on Western civilization. Here's the problem that you have with this. I don't know what they mean by white supremacism. I don't know what the definition is. But if you accept the definition, then you've already accepted the debate. But look at this. I mean, I hate to tell you, but modern civilization with its cars and airplanes and all of the scientific advances and the medical advances didn't come out of Africa, for the most part, didn't come out of China. There were contributions made from various countries, but it largely came out of Western civilization from the Middle Ages moving forward, including the idea of freedom and that slavery is a bad idea. Okay, if you want to see slavery, there are places in the world today it still exists. And if these people really cared about it, then they would do it. Now, they would go over there and take care of it. Unfortunately, they might be executed in those countries if they did. See, that's the problem. And so while they're condemning the civilization, at the same time, they refuse to leave it and its benefits. That's the chief hypocrisy to all of this claim about white supremacism. Christianity is, by its very nature, non-racial. I mean, God starts out, there's no longer Jew nor Gentile, but all are one in Christ Jesus. That's where we start. And whenever the church went off that track, it was wrong. Okay.
That's such a great point, though, that we should underline is that the left is actually benefiting from the very same freedoms, the freedom of free speech, of association, to get their ideology out there. They're benefiting from that where they wouldn't in other cultures and nations and countries. And they're using the very mechanism that allows the freedom to actually cut it off. I mean, it's and so for students who are part of this, for young people who are a part of this, they have to think about that. They have to think, why would I be exercising my freedom of speech to then rail on and rant against someone else's freedom of association or their free speech? I mean, it's a self-defeating argument that students really need to understand.
What you need to understand is all of these elite arguments are all self-contradicting. I talk about people standing on a constantly pitching deck of constantly changing, self-contradicting ideas, and they're demanding that we follow them at every single step. And if you look at it on college campuses, they talk about diversity. They're not diverse. They want absolute uniformity dogmatically. They say that we should be tolerant. They're not tolerant. They are hideously intolerant of anyone who disagrees with them ideologically. Look at the gentleman who just got fired from Google for saying they didn't have enough ideological broadness. The latest joke is safe spaces. Well, we all need our safe spaces because I can't handle these ideas. Oh my, I just gotta know. You know, and but the problem is for anybody who dissents, there is no safe space. You can be viciously attacked on a college campus if you believe it. So everything you're telling us is one giant contradiction.
It is. And there was a great article that I just sent you last night, John, that was written by a student in the United Kingdom who was who came over to a New York university and wrote a really great perspective about her year that was spent at an American university and actually living with and encountering this type of hypocrisy and this idea that her ideas were not welcome, even though supposedly everyone deserves a safe space. And the salient quotation here was she writes, the university experience in America is is now not one that will adequately prepare students for real life. In real life democracy, people disagree. And normally they don't die or suffer emotional injury because of it. In normal life, there's no reason not to like someone with whom you disagree politically. On campus, opinions are often ontology. You are what you think. But this is dangerous logic. If I hate what you think, I must hate what you are. And that's exactly, John, what we're seeing on today's liberal campuses, is that you have to buy into the left's progressive agenda. And if you don't, you don't actually have the same safe space ability as the demand that they have for their ideas. And so so I thought this was a great article. And how would you describe this phenomenon in academia and where it's heading?
Spanish Inquisition. It's following all the dynamics of any kind of an inquisitional totalitarian situation. There is an orthodoxy, and anyone that's always done in the name of good, and anyone who dissents from that will be mercilessly persecuted. And what we have to keep doing is, and I hate to say it this way, I'm just going to use an Alinsky tactic, laughing at and pointing out all of the contradictions. It's like the statement, and it starts with this, all of this stuff you're talking about starts with the idea that there are no absolute truths. Well, do you believe that? Absolutely. Yes. Well, then you just contradicted yourself. Oh, well, there are no absolute truths except the absolute truth that there are no absolute truths. This is how convoluted it gets. And so your next word should be, who said? Where did you get this idea? You know, the same thing we have about hate. Hate is simply the unpardonable sin du jour out there. And so if you can sling the word hater at somebody, we even have organizations like You Know Who that monitor hate, and they put a bunch of Christian organizations on their hate list and whatever. What's the purpose of monitoring hate? So that we can learn to hate them. Okay. And so, and Jesus said, you can't conquer hate with hate, but you can do it with reasoned argument, with showing people that you care. You know, in the last 12 months, I've driven about 10,000 miles across all parts of this country for various purposes. I just got back from Arizona.
Were you there for the Trump rally?
No, I left just before the Trump rally. I was there. My 97-year-old father-in-law was visiting him. And but I left there. I out in the middle of the desert, 105 degree heat. I'm talking to a Navajo woman in the supermarket in Phoenix. This retired black man comes whizzing around the corner of one of the rows on this electric cart because his legs weren't working right anymore. And I looked at him and I said, "Man, you sure drive a mean cart." And he laughed, you know. And we started to talk. And he was from Chicago, and I'm from Illinois. And we talked for a long time and had a wonderful time of it. Ran into a liberal couple from Colorado waiting for the eclipse to start. We watched the eclipse from the Star Valley in western Wyoming and eastern Idaho, and you know, talked to them about global warming and the problems with that. And we disagreed on stuff, but we wished each other a good trip. I saw one bumper sticker I didn't like. It was on some obvious redneck's pickup truck, and it said, "I detest liberals." You can't do that. I said, that doesn't contribute to the conversation. You have to love the people you're talking to, but you cannot buy into their premises. And I'm sorry, when you deal with social justice warriors, Jenna, you're dealing with a person who is out there to destroy you in the name of doing good. You must recognize that when you're under attack by them.
That is so, so true. And we're talking with John Loeffler, who is the host of Steel on Steel. You can find him at steelonsteel.com. And John, it's such a great point to say that, you know, that you actually were talking to these people face to face. And I think that one of the unfortunately collateral consequences that has aided the left in getting their agenda out there and having people more buy into this this sort of premise that if I hate what you think, I must hate what you are, and actually hate the person themselves, is because we're no longer, by and large, talking to people face to face and having to confront that reality that they're a fellow human being. I mean, we see so much of this conversation happens just through the media, through social media especially. And how much easier is it to hate a person and to just to do exactly what that bumper sticker says, just, you know, call them libtards, call them, you know, whatever, all of these names, and not actually recognize and give them that value of being human beings. And so if we can have these conversations in person, that I think will help at least advance this understanding that we're talking to another human being. I mean, so how can we take the conversation primarily out of social media and get it back around the dinner table?
Well, that's always the challenge, especially if people are dealing in stereotypes. As I've said, intellectually, the right is winning the arguments. They have the ammo on their side. The political left tries to keep the right from expressing their viewpoints, and by using epithets, those are called argumentum ad baculum, argumentum ad populum, you know, all of these logical fallacies. I know you mentioned Salon Magazine. Salon Magazine is so hideously left and so full of fallacies and errors, it's just not even... I go there to see what's going on.
Exactly, yeah, just to go to see what ridiculous non-arguments they're advancing.
That's exactly it. If you read the difference between, say, a Thomas Sowell or a Charles Krauthammer and some of the people writing for the Huffington Post, you know, there's an old statement, argument weak, speak louder, use many words. And you read through an article and you realize, yeah, they threw some facts in there, but they didn't build an argument, whereas Thomas Sowell and Charles Krauthammer, they build their argument. So the right has the moral high ground. The left always has to hijack it. The real thing is, first of all, to challenge. Like I've said, you say, how do we do it? The first thing you do is just pray. Anytime you're in a conversation with people, Lord, show me what's going on here, you know, before you start into anything. And I do that when I travel. I like to talk to people, you know, especially of different races and subgroups, and see what's going on. We are not as divided as they would have us believe. And that's the first thing we need to recognize. They are causing this division for political gain and have been causing it since the days of the civil rights movement. Martin Luther King's goal was that we don't judge each other on the character of our skin. Why, 60 years out from this whole movement, are we still chattering away and talking about it? Because there is political gain to be made from it.
And yeah, that's the dialogue. And they're winning the minds of the youth, and they are wanting to play on this emotional fervor rather than having a lucid, coherent, rational conversation.
Right. But it works. So now the first step you do is, and President Trump made his comment in Phoenix, is, I will tell you, you can't put your kids in secular atheist institutions, which are totally lopsided in their worldview and their outlook, and expect them to come out anything but secular atheists, even if they still say they're Christians. The second thing is to start schools. The third thing is to start colleges and make sure that they get the right education, because they will enter the workforce. You cannot. A student is a vulnerable person, especially in grade school and high school, where the group thinking is all important, and all of radical leftism revolves around group consensus. They can't stand there and be salt like. It's very, very difficult. Only a few people can do it.
And I don't think that it makes any sense whatsoever to send an unprepared warrior into a war zone, frankly. I mean, our military wouldn't take a recruit from, you know, yesterday, give him no weapons training experience, anything, and send him to the front lines. But that's essentially exactly what we're doing with our children, sending them into public education and even into the collegiate level and academia. I mean, we have to realize and not buy into, John, that narrative that somehow secular institutions have no religion at all. They definitely do. And we have to make sure that our kids and our young people are prepared first before they go into those types of environments.
Yeah, and what's really neat is that there are a lot of millennials who have figured out that something's wrong, but they're having a hard time figuring out what's wrong because they got a one-sided diet while they were in education. And that's where you and I step in on this whole thing. I really do care about millennials. I'm trying to reach across the generations. I'm 68, and I'm trying to reach across the generations and give you the benefit of having lived since World War II, and we went through all these changes and what fascism was all about. When people say fascism today, they have not a clue of what that means. All right. Right. I mean, fascists are socialists. And, you know, whether you look at a Marxist socialist or a fascist socialist, there wasn't much difference between Stalin's Russia and Hitler's Germany, except maybe the uniforms. Okay?
And so quickly, everything John, else. Then for the millennials who are listening to this program, how should they understand what the definition of fascism, the definition of Marxism?
Well, they're both totalitarian. First of all, they both endorse each of these societies has an orthodoxy in belief. Like you said, they all have a religious belief system. They all enforce it. It's from top down. Slight differences in economics, but they both endorse socialism and consensus group thinking. They all had a secret police that enforced these things, and they all had a prison system which imprisoned people who disagreed with it, just like inside the Islamic world today in some countries. Okay, so that's that. In a nutshell, that's the difference between the two. Whereas we believe in freedom for everybody, regardless of religion or race or origin, the freedom to speak and debate. We believe in a free market, capitalist system. Those are the things that we stand. And you need to understand, people will put fascism on the right and Marxism on the left. Don't do that. Bend that line and make it a circle. At the top of the circle is freedom, freedom of thought, conscience, religion, free markets. At the bottom of the circle is totalitarianism. It doesn't make any difference if you go around the left side or the right side of the circle. When you get to the bottom, it will look the same.
Absolutely. And it's really important to draw that distinction to say our founders wanted freedom of thought, speech, religion, so that we could persuade others of what we believe, not through coercive manipulation and through force. I mean, we were talking about hate speech earlier and hate crimes. I mean, I think that's absolutely ridiculous to say that just that the same act motivated from a different premise is somehow worse. The act is the act, and we have to make sure that we draw that distinction. So, John Loeffler, quickly, we're out of time. Where can people find you and your work?
They can listen to our short show every week on all the major podcast sites. Our main site is steelonsteel.com, and I urge everyone to join our Praying for Persecuted Christian site on Facebook. It's a special thing for us.
All right, thanks so much, John, and we'll be right back with Attorney-Client Privilege here on KLZ 560.